Well, good evening, everybody, and welcome to Far Corners. I can't believe how happy I am to see you all. I didn't know if I was going to get here. And just knowing the people that were going to come made me really want to be here and take part in this. So we'll see what happens. No guarantee about anything. How many were at the first Far Corners? Wow, we got about 7 or 8. I'll just tell you a little of the history about this. I just woke up about 3 in the morning, about 6 years ago, and it was just clear as a bell what this plan was going to be. And even the name Far Corners, that it was not going to be announced locally, that we wouldn't allow any groups. You could bring one friend, but no groups coming because they just hang around together. That we would rely on word of mouth, and we would hope to get a lot of old timers so that those of you that were approaching being old timers would find fascinating company to be with over the weekend. And that it would not be Alcoholics Anonymous, even though we're all members. We would use our full names, we wouldn't have the preamble, it would be totally separate. And it would be the springboard out of our program, as suggested in the 11th step in both the Big Book and the 12 and 12, to explore other avenues of spirituality. And so we got a library, and we had some crazy lectures. Those of you that remember me, Tarzan, and you, Jane, I can't believe I did that. We even had a stretching routine. That was when I was healthy. And so what it was a chance to just explore in an unlimited way what you might say was the far corners of spirituality, the universe, or whatever it was. And I think I knew within a week or two, as it started to form, that this was not going to be a linear event like a state convention where you just go on and on and on, get another chairman and go on and on, that this was going to be something that had a beginning and an ending. And this is going to be the ending. It is coming in for a landing after our journey. It's almost as if we started in AA and the great foundation of our program, that I don't think a single word should be changed anywhere in there. And then looking at the both 11 steps where they say our libraries are full of books and there's speakers and people to listen to and go out and see what is available and use it to bring your AA program into the fourth dimension or the third dimension or whatever you want to call it, because there's such a wealth of spiritual knowledge available, and we try to get books to do that and have lectures that went off the chart. But it was all designed like a prodigal son journey, so that we would take it and come back home and then see that all the answers were here all along. That there isn't anything more powerful than what's been written in our literature. It's just that we went where we could see it more clearly. Maybe you took a book and an author explained humility to you like you never had it before. And so you came back to your AA program with this extra dimension on humility or forgiveness. All of the qualities that our program has. And I know that part of me is disappointed, but part of me knows that once something ends, something new is going to take its place, and that's what scares me. What the hell are we going to do next? And we'll just have to wait and see. Now, for those of you that haven't been here before, we have a question box somewhere. If it's not up now, it'll be up. Oh, it's in the back. And we asked you when you came to bring a spiritual question. And my friend Jerry Jones has gracefully volunteered to do one of the hours, and I'll do the other hour. And I think you'll find the questions and answers are fascinating, because you hear the question and you kind of have an idea what you think the answer is. And then you hear something that is quite different. And both of them may be true, but it's nice to be able to hear with an open mind other ideas on what the answer to these questions might be. It reminds me of that book, I Am That, that we had in the back there, where this guru from India who had became totally awakened, and people from Europe and America would come to sit in his presence just to feel the awakening energy and to ask him questions. And so the whole book is questions from the travelers from around the world, followed by his answer. And of course, when you're reading it, you read the guy from England, he asks the question, you go, Jesus, anybody knows the answer to that. And you've got it formed in your head, and then you read what the guru said, and you go, well, I guess I missed that a little bit. It was so. I was a little off. And you realize that as people's perspective changes, they see things differently and they come out with different answers. It's all what you see. Like when you first came to AA, you just saw a terrible burden that had been imposed on you. You didn't even ask to come here, most of you. And as the years go by, you just see that this is the most precious gift that was ever given to you. It was being forced in here. And so I find that a lot of fun, to keep working on this and just see things differently. So one of the things you'll see are these holograms on the side of the walls around here. And feel free throughout the whole weekend to go up and look at these things until you see the third dimension. And I always tell this story, but I never saw one until about 20 years ago, and I was at my son's house in Baltimore, and they'd just come out or something, and everybody was looking at it in the hallway. Oh, and even the grandchildren going, oh, yeah, yeah. Everyone got it but me. And it was really irritating me. So I put my nose up close, and then I'd back up, and then during dinner, I kept going to the bathroom so I could go back by this thing. I never saw it. I went home without seeing it. And I know there's been guys who came here who didn't see it the first year and saw it the second year. To see this image open up that is very similar to seeing something in another dimension, and that's why we have them up. And also, when you go down, do we have the St. Francis thing up on the, is that up or not?
Yes.
It is up?
Yes.
Okay. They have a walkway, it's on your map, that is where you can meditate, and they have the Ten Commandments with little benches to sit down, and they've allowed us to put a line from the prayer of St. Francis in front of each one of those. So when you go out, you could sit and reflect on one of our greatest prayers. And then, of course, the books, do we go straight through or is it around? Okay. Anyway, you got to go outside and go around and back. We used to have... Oh, they're right back there. Thank you. See what happens when you're late. You haven't got a clue what's going on. So the reason that I am bringing this up... Oh, yeah, Stations of the Cross. Okay. Oh, what did I say? Ten Commandments. No, Stations of the Cross. We want, at the end of this, for all the books to be gone. And we want those off the wall, and the St. Francis, in other words, we want you to take it home and take three books home and spread them around, because they'll reach some people who otherwise might never have had that. And I'm just mentioning it now, but we'll mention it again later on, so you don't forget. And I think that's a nice way of distributing the energy that has been felt here at these various events. And somebody will be getting a book that was looked at by five other guys and maybe influence them. And you can take it back to Seattle or wherever and give it to somebody, and who knows what it might do. And then you can take home a hologram and after a couple of years finally see the damn thing. So that'll solve the resentment that you had, which would be nice. And so the thinking behind this was that word of mouth and would somehow bring people from various places. And as we look back, we had people from Brazil and Iceland. The Iceland guys come down here like we're the neighbor. They're here all the time. And Scotland and Ireland, et cetera. So we feel pretty good about the way this unfolded. And it may be sad that it's ending, but it's really was intended to do that. It was intended to finish a cycle and accomplish this. And so I was looking at the, I think the first handout that we ever had was the pertinent passages, which I'm gonna, are gonna be a play of a role over the weekend. We never did read them. But I'm just saying, when you look at powerful spiritual wordage, you just look at the first four or five, and that only gets us 50 pages into the big book. And we have the doctor's opinion saying, one feels that something more than human power is needed to produce the essential psychic effect. And then page 25, we found much of heaven and have been rocketed into the fourth dimension of existence, of which we had never even dreamed. The central fact of our lives today, this is one of my favorite lines, page 25, is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. So you can see that whatever we read in these other books that took us to places that seemed higher, it's all here. And what we hope is that as you come back and look at our program again, it blossoms up to another level of perception. And you find it even more comforting. And you find more wisdom. And you just find things that you didn't see last year. And I think that's a common thing in AA. Hey, Chris, can you help me get this off? Is you read the book again, and something, let me put this down. It got warmer in here. No, I can take this off. It's just the reason is I can't think of anything to say, and this is a good way to kill some time. Thank you. Chris and them were worried because I haven't made sense in 2 months. And we thought maybe a miracle would happen, but it hasn't happened yet. So I think that's all the thinking on Far Corners. It's I feel that this is exactly the way it should be done, that this is correct. And I hope you all understand. I know that some kind of plan this every year. but anyway, that's enough on that. Now, there's supposed to be a topic. Topic is, for all three of them, is our society. And that's a word that Bill liked to use, the society of AA, which is probably the same as the fellowship, but I like the word, a society, you know what I mean? It's got a lot of class to it. And Bill liked to call AA an utter simplicity, which encases a complete mystery. That's a pretty interesting sentence, isn't it? Here we have our co-founder and our primary writer with 25 years of sobriety reflecting on our society and coming up with an utter simplicity which encases a complete mystery. And when Dr. Bob said, keep it simple, he was saying a sentence that irritates every self-centered alcoholic because they don't like simplicity. None of us like simplicity. So when we have something that's an utter simplicity, we like complicated things so that we can't do them. Well, I mean, it's just, you know, there's 12 parts to this thing. I don't think I'll ever get it finished. But if it's simple, there's no excuse for not completing it. It's so simple, you just do this. And it also leaves no room for our own creativity to be applied to the solution. And we don't like moving through life without inputting our own ideas into the situation. Whereas we have a program that is so simple, you simply follow the directions and then evaluate the results. And I remember going, that's cool, I like that, but I see a couple places that could use a little improving there. It's just amazing. So an utter simplicity means we don't need any of your ideas. Period. We don't need you to raise your hand and go, you know, AA would be a lot better if we did this or if we did that. It's already hammered down to the essence, and it simply needs to be done. And so we have this just miraculous layout of the big book and the 12 and 12 and the way the steps are written. And when they're followed with a good sponsor, it produces consistently spiritual awakenings, which are the most cherished experience that man can have. Now, a lot of people in the business world don't know that. They think a Jaguar might be the most powerful. But for those of us that have experienced this, we realize that to find out that there is a creator who cares about us, and we find out by experiencing this, it's something that we just are so grateful for. You end up being grateful that you're an alcoholic. I'm actually grateful that I got thrown in this crazy place and got dragged kicking and screaming into doing this stuff that everybody else is doing. And then I had to admit I was wrong. There really is such a thing as a higher power, and I experienced it. So Bill comes up with, it's an utter simplicity, meaning there's going to be a lot of resistance to it. People fight AA, that's why. It's too simple. They want to bring input in. They want to just go, look, before we work the program, why don't I tell you about me? Isn't that the tendency that, you're going to help me? Okay, good. Let me tell you all about me. Otherwise, how could you help me? How could you tailor the help to me? I'm a complicated, unique individual, so certainly you would need to know all about me before you decide what help I need. And, of course, in AA, we just laugh. And we go, no, we don't want to hear about you. I'm going to tell you about me. And then we share, as a recovered alcoholic, what our lives were like. And we watch this man's eyes light up when he finds somebody who's just like him. And that's our process of identification. I might actually listen to this person. He seems to know what it is to be like me. So we have this simplicity that encases a complete mystery. And of course, the mystery is God. And the mystery is we don't have a clue about anything here. We couldn't tell if 10 newcomers came, which 5 are going to get sober. We've got a clue. We haven't got a clue which person with 25 years is going to go out this July. This is a mystery. Try and explain AA to your friends verbally. What do you do at those meetings? Oh, man, dude, it's the greatest. I am just so, yeah, I can see you're happy, and I'm just curious, what do you do there that gets you so, oh, Jesus. Like Tuesday night, we have a discussion meeting, and one of us will come up with like a topic, you know, like resentment or something like that. And then we go around the room and everybody tells what they think about that. And then we say the Lord's Prayer and go home. It's great. You want to come? And we just explained verbally what happens. And they are absolutely clueless. But if we brought them to a meeting, an open meeting, so they could see it, and they experienced the energy, then they would understand it. So AA can only be experienced. It really can't be understood. You cannot write down why AA works. Why go make stupid amends? You feel better. It just can't be explained. So everything, and what about its origin? I mean, God, there's another quote that I think it's Ernie Kurtz, but I'm not positive. And it's, I'll probably screw it up, but it really describes our society pretty well. And it says, in an almost magical manner, Alcoholics Anonymous is able to bring to its religious and non-religious members alike a view of the universe and their place in it, which is both powerful and exciting. In doing so, they borrowed from religion everything which is uniting, and I think it's powerful, while politely declining everything that is self-serving and conflicting. It might be called the spiritual heist of the century. And they did it all unconsciously without realizing it. So all that happened without anybody planning it. It just ended up that way. The steps ended up the way they're written. And when you look at our history and look at the input that came from various sources, and I often talk about what we might call the Big Bang of AA. I probably have done this a few times. And I suppose there would be three choices. One might be Ebby coming to see Bill and the impression that he left. It was so powerful. He couldn't stop looking at Ebby. It wasn't what he was saying. It was the energy that was coming out of his friend. And he couldn't believe that this was his friend. He couldn't believe it. And the other one might be at the payphone in the Mayflower Hotel when things could have gone one way or the other. And somehow Bill persisted in that. And my favorite is Bill's experience in Towns Hospital when out of desperation he just said, well, if there is a God, let him show himself. And the room lit up and the Bill never drank again, and he was obsessed with the drive to save every alcoholic in the world. And all that happened in a millisecond. 1 minute, there was no hope for any alcoholics in the world, and 10 seconds later, we had the origin of this program that has gotten 2 or 3 million people sober in whatever it is. I've forgotten the numbers, 130 countries, and however many groups it is. All from this moment. And we could look at this, that this was something that happened in 1934, which is one way of looking at it, or you could say that it's still happening. That energy that hit Bill is now hitting other people as it continues this wonderful gift from God. It's hard to see that that didn't come that way. Initially, you might say, well, you know, he's in the detox place, he's given these things, and that could have been a hallucination or whatever. But as time has gone by, and we look at the results that came out of that, there's very little doubt that this was the moment when alcoholics were going to have a chance at happiness, which they never had before. There wasn't a chance. There was just nothing. Amazing to look at the medical history of what they did to alcoholics, and it's just astounding. And then this comes along, and I think sometimes I forget to reflect on that, that we're here because of that moment, and we know each other, and we share this. Everybody here, it's already bonded with one another because of the fact that we're alcoholic. We don't have to say anything else. We already know. Hi, Fred. Yeah, I'm an alcoholic. So am I. Well, I know a lot about you. And you know a lot about me. And you know that you didn't come here on a roll. And that your life was very painful. And the damage that we caused with others, the conflict, all of that. And we're stuck with it. We get sober and then we have this past. And it seems like we're going to be haunted with it for the rest of our lives until we start through the steps. And we get to 6 and 7 and 8 and 9. And we watch bitter enemies become friends. We watch the power of amends. We watch the power of forgiveness. And our past changes. There was somebody running around some of our meetings, maybe about 8 years ago, and he said his favorite quote was, "Abandon all hope of changing your past." And I disagree with him. I disagree with him 100%. Your vision of the past isn't accurate. That was your self-centered perspective on all of that. And as we go through these steps, you're going to find that your past starts taking shape into the reality that it really is. I've told the story of Los Angeles, and a guy comes up and says, "I think I know you." And I said, "Well, I've never seen you." And he said, "No, I think I know you. In 1962, you were in an airplane on a cross country going back to Cherry Point, and you declared an oxygen emergency, and all the planes had to land, and you never flew again." And I said, "How do you know that?" And he said, "I was in the plane with you." And here it is, 40 years later, I run into the guy that was sitting in the right-hand seat. And that was the last that I flew. My drinking made it so that I couldn't even get in the plane. I was so frightened. I thought I was going to have a seizure. All these things were happening. So I went to the colonel and said, "I'm not going to fly anymore." And he said, "Why?" And I said, "Well, I can't tell you. I'm just not going to do it." He said, "You've been doing it for almost 14 and a half years. This is your whole career in the Marine Corps. Now, I'm just not going to do it anymore." He said, "Okay, well, then I'm going to have to write the Commandant of the Marine Corps And we're going to have to get you assigned to something else, which was killing me because I didn't want to do anything else. But I didn't know how to get out of the box I was in. I had been climbing in these planes for the better part of a year, and I was having withdrawal in the plane, and I was just freaking out. It was just so scary. I almost ejected a couple times. I mean, it was just this terrible stuff. And so it took about 3 months, and I did the legal work for that squadron. And I would not make eye contact with any of the pilots. I was so ashamed. And I could tell by looking on their face, they're going, how did that piece of crap get in this squadron? This is a really fancy squadron, photo squadron, the F-8 during the Cuban Missile Crisis and all that. And so I left there after 3 months of shame. And every time I thought about that period of time, I felt shame. That was the most shame that I had in my past. So my friend comes the next day to another convention and brings photographs and all this from the squadron. I'm just going, God, that's it. Yeah, I remember him. Yeah, okay. And then he said, did you know how popular you were in that squadron? This was killing us that you were leaving. The colonel was trying, this is before they didn't have treatment, and nobody knew about AA, the squadron anyway. He said the colonel was calling all his friends and trying to find a way to save you from this. It just killed us. When you left there, we were so sad. And I went, well, that's not how I remember it. So I had to go back 42 years and plug in the truth and get rid of my past, the one I had, the story I had about that moment in time. So we have the shaping of this society that I like to think about. And contained in it are millions of people with their own ideas about what should be done or whether things should be changed. And yet we get along in a rather remarkable fashion. To me, the thing that is the core of this particular society is the power to work a miracle in the lives of a hopeless human being. That's the signature power of Alcoholics Anonymous. The power to work a miracle in the lives of a hopeless human being. And these miracles sometimes become so numerous that we forget they're miracles. Oh, yeah, he got sober. Yeah, yep. I knew he would. And his wife is really happy, and he's happy. His marriage is saved. Just another event, as if it could be caused non-spiritually, as if there was some process that could be followed that would produce this result. And prior to coming here, we all tried the psychiatrists and the psychologists and all that, and we're talking and we're going, I need help with my problem, my do-do-do-do-do, and nothing happened. Nothing. And then we came here and took steps we didn't believe in. Didn't make no sense to us. But after they worked, we took credit for, yeah, I knew that would work. I knew. I knew that was going to help a lot to go make amends to my mother-in-law. So don't believe people when you hear them saying, I eagerly went after the steps. their sponsor had a stranglehold on them. And after they finished, they took credit for it. It's a little trick we play in AA. We make believe we really enjoy doing this stuff. Oh, yeah. I love taking inventories. I love calling somebody every day. I love, read page 82. All right, Jesus. Read page whatever the hell it is. You know, 10 years later, you can hardly wait to read that page again. I mean, how about 164, just the last closeout on that page? I mean, God, if that doesn't make you feel chills to just think about that. So something got assembled by the year 1939 that, and there certainly wasn't a society yet. This thing was, who knew if it was going to continue to exist? But somehow that book got written. And even the book was written to get money. It wasn't written to, you know, well, we need a textbook, we'll do all that. We can't raise money by hitting up the millionaires. They're not buying into our deal. So we'll write a book and sell a million copies. And then we can get on with the missionaries and the paid drunk tanks and hospitals and all that stuff. And here we end up with, I don't know how many million copies that is sold. It has to be over 10, maybe 15. Do you know? 17?
30.
Oh, my God. And so something happened to give us this society that we're all part of. And if you were to describe this society, I know I would have a very hard time, because as you travel around to different states and countries, AA is exactly the same, but entirely different at the same time. They're just going to be differences because of different customs, a different country, a different whatever. And yet, at the heart of all of this is this identification of one alcoholic to another with the intent, I mean, the sole purpose being to lead this man or woman to their creator. So they experience that. To me, that's the simplicity of how to keep our program on target. One problem, alcoholism, one solution, God. And as Chuck C. would say, if you're going, you're either going away from God or you're going nearer to God. And it's better to be going nearer to God. But we're going to experience both because we're human beings with egos. And there's times when we're just not going to practice the presence. As Brother Lawrence, that's one of the great books. Oh, my goodness. If you haven't run across that, Practicing the Presence by Brother Lawrence. A little skinny book, mostly little letters that he wrote. I don't know, it's probably over 1,000 years ago. And his words are just the essence of simplicity. I remember one, he's writing to this nun and says, whenever I sit in God's presence, I feel very humble because he's God and I'm not. it just says it all. He's God and I'm not. The idea that we're not God is revolutionary, because everyone feels that they're the center of their own life, and therefore there must be, that they are really their own power. And so they don't need another God coming in. We got one already. And even though it's all screwed up, it's not their fault. And so we have this battle that goes on. And I found in this sickness, with a lot of pain and just losing energy, I lost about 30 pounds of muscle weight, that the contact was much harder to keep. But there was an absolute assurance that it was still there. And that's a wonderful feeling, because of all these years, is to go, yeah, I can't experience that right now, but there's no doubt in my mind that it's just as present as it was before. It's a very comforting thing in the midst of discomfort. It's almost like you have the two things going on at the same time. And while I'm on the subject, the number of cards that I got, phone calls from people all over, I just can't thank everybody enough. It was, I'm just very grateful. And also I want to mention my friend Chris. You all know Chris. Well, he's saved my life. He's there. He was there when my daughter was murdered, and he was there when I had other surgeries, and he and his wife. And then Peter Howell. Peter, raise your hand back there. Peter stayed with me when I came home from the hospital, and was there when the heart went bad and all that stuff happened. And he's been just a... He could tell you how unspiritual I am. And so I wish you would refrain from having long conversations with him about anything. Because, boy, I really can be pretty bad. I don't want to go into the next level of talking about our society. I'm just trying to think of other things that took place to get it started. And I'll tell you one. The longer I'm around reading different books, I think we had this book back there. Uncommon Friends. Did we have that back there? You remember seeing it? So I'll tell you about the book, because I can't think of anything else to say. Oh, yeah, Chris has it. This is a guy, James Newton, who wrote about his own life and how he was a close confidant to Thomas Edison, Harvey Firestone, Henry Ford, Charles Lindbergh, and a doctor won the Nobel Peace Prize from France for coming up with ways of treating wounds in soldiers so they had a much better chance of living. So pretty high energy people. And he was down in Fort Myer developing real estate during the crash of 29. And across the street is Thomas Edison. And they become friends. And Edison's amazed that this guy's succeeding people are buying these freaking houses. And he just can't quite understand it. So they become quite good friends. So much so that when Firestone comes to visit him and asks Edison if he knows anybody who could be his right-hand man in running Firestone Rubber Company, Edison said, "This is your man, James Newton." And he accepts the job and goes to Akron. Does such a good job, Firestone wants to give him the business. That's how close. And after he was there a while, he noticed that Firestone's son was a raging alcoholic. And Newton had been attending Oxford group meetings for himself and his own interest. And while attending them, he saw a few drunks sober up. So he took Firestone's son on a business trip with him and then asked him if he would like to go to one of the weekends, the Oxford group weekends, where all the high-powered people were there and Buckman might have been there giving the talk. And he went. And he got sober. And it kind of transformed him. And his father noticed. He said, "Geez, what happened to it?" He said, "Oh, I went to the Oxford." "Really?" He said, "What is that?" He said, "Oh, it's this big society thing, and the people go there and they find God. They try to become better people. They want to be better citizens. They want to do all this. Well, we got to get that in Akron." So Firestone calls Buckman and says, "Oh, I want a big deal in Akron of this Oxford group thing." And all the papers had it. "Come to the Oxford thing. Firestone is invited. You're all invited." So here's this newspaper going out telling everybody in Akron, including Ann Smith and Henrietta Seiberling, that this thing you ought to attend. And they did attend. And they became regular members. And Ann brought Dr. Bob there on a regular basis. So if James Newton hadn't been in the game, Oxford may not have gotten to Akron, and there wouldn't have been any phone lists for Bill to call, and Dr. Bob and Bill may have never met. All because this one person played this little role. Now when you read his book, he sees AA and all these things that happen from his point of view, and it's rather interesting. And when I look at the pictures in there, I just can't imagine some one man being that close to all those other. And at the end of the book, he talks about how spiritual every one of them was and how much they cared for their fellow man. And it's quite a testimonial. I think I'm running out of energy. And with your permission, I'm going to just stop now. And we'll let Chris give you 2 hours of announcements, which I think you're going to love. Thanks, Lee.